stranded assets.
Thank you, Your Honour. So I'm working through the joint witness statement and I move on to the topic of stranded assets, which commences at paragraph 18 on page 7. Now, some suggested drafting has been included at paragraph 20, including some drafting for the policy and also some drafting for the restricted discretionary activity rule. The first matter that I wish to discuss was the narrowing down of the application of the stranded asset provisions to viticulture and orchards, and the joint witness statement records that the evidence that has been given only related to those topics. Now, that may well have been the case up until we heard from Southern Lakes Holdings on yesterday, Monday, where there was some suggestion that extra main lines had been installed with respect to pasture. But as I also read the joint witness statement, there was also a comment made about a lack of evidence in relation to the effects associated with activities other than viticulture and horticulture. So my first question is, does the recommendation change in light of the evidence that was given by Southern Holdings or Southern Lakes Holdings Limited on Monday with respect to the recommendation? And I appreciate that it may only be Mr. De Pelsmaker and possibly Ms. King who heard that evidence.
Tom De Pelsmaker. I'm just going to speak for myself now, and my colleagues may disagree with me. Despite having heard yesterday's evidence, there's still, and that is the same actually for orchards and viticultures, we don't know what the demand is or what the uptake is going to be. We also heard some evidence previously about there is a difference in terms of potential impacts between horticulture, viticulture on one side, and pasture as well. Pasture being having a higher risk potentially for sediment, E. coli, nutrient leaching. So with that in mind, I am tempted to stay with the recommendation in terms of the rule. I did wonder about whether it would be appropriate to perhaps change the amendment to the policy, because the policy, the proposed amendment to the policy 10A21, sets out two tests. One related to land use, you have to be horticulture or viticulture, sorry, orchards or viticulture. And the second one is around infrastructure being in place at a certain time. So if you remove one test, that would allow for consents to be granted to expand the area under irrigation for pasture under a non-complying framework. I think as currently proposed or recommended, the policy is almost like an insurmountable hurdle. The non-complying framework also gives you better opportunity to look at the environmental effects, which I think are warranted given that there is a higher risk there. That's my preliminary response to that.
Now, I may have lost the thread there. So you're recommending, in light of the evidence, you're not recommending any further changes
to the rule
and no changes to the policy. So you're...
No. Remove one test. So remove the restriction to land use. That is potentially one way we could address it. Remove the reference to orchards and viticulture.
In the policy,
but leave it in the rule. So the RDA is constrained to only apply viticulture and orchards, pasture could come in under non-compliant and have a reasonable chance of being granted consent. That's my preliminary thinking on that.
So remove the reference to orchard and viticulture in the policy.
Yes.
Leave it in the rule, the RDA rule.
Yes.
Pasture come in if it wants to come in as a non-complying activity. Yeah.
Yeah. And like I said, the reason behind it is because there is a higher risk potentially. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Against which objectives and policies would then such an application and its effects fall to be assessed?
That would be under the amended or the newly proposed objective 10A113, I think. Under version B.
So they're not compromising the future
yes.
implementation?
Correct, because in my view, that includes the whole spectrum duration as well as looking at the effects. And then obviously also under policy 10A21 and policy 10A23 on duration.
Ms. King, is there sufficient policy, and I include objective in that, guidance for you to consider how an application to increase the area of pastoral land under irrigation might be assessed? So if the policy was broadened such that a non-complying application for increased irrigated pasture was to be lodged, is there sufficient guidance for you to know how to go about processing that?
Alexandra King, I think are you saying in terms of if it was consistent with all policies?
Mr. De Pelsmaker's preliminary recommendation is that the policy should not the policy should be broader such that it's not orchard and viticulture land that's being enabled in a sense. So if an application came in for pastoral land to be, a further area of pastoral land to be irrigated as a non-complying activity, where would you look for guidance on how to process that application in terms of the other objectives and policies in the Plan Change 7?
I think the information in there is quite light. I think considering the orchard and viticulture can be assessed under the RDA and you've got your list of matters of discretion to look to, and non-complying, there's not a lot of support in there in terms of what to be assessing.
Okay.
Isn't that the point of a non-complying activity? You don't usually expect policy guidance. Or am I being too glib?
In terms of the how you might actually come back to assess the effects, so the guidance on what might be appropriate from an effects perspective when considering a non-complying activity, there, in my submission, there often is guidance to be found in the objectives and policies of the plan. More so the case where you have a complete plan with the full suite, whereas given the procedural nature of Plan Change 7, there seems to be a policy vacuum for how you might actually go about considering on its merit a non-complying activity. And that may or may not be a problem. I'm just interested to know how, in practice, if that type of application was to be lodged, it would be considered.
All right. So how would you consider the effects of the expansion of the irrigation area where irrigation infrastructure is already in situ, which is the Southern Lakes example yesterday. So how would you go about looking at effects and determining effects? The acceptability of effects or otherwise?
Yes, well, as I was saying, it is quite light in terms of guidance in the Plan Change 7. So you would look to higher order documents to potentially provide guidance on where to be looking. I can't think of anything specifically currently, but that's what I would do.
Ms. Dicey, Ms. Perkins.
Sally Dicey, so going back to your original question, I mean, through this conferencing and with the additional option that we've kind of added in terms of specifying orchards in viticulture, and then hearing from Southern Lakes yesterday, I mean, one option that had been playing on my mind was whether by specifying and limiting a pathway to orchards and viticulture, it would be possible to make that a controlled activity pathway, and then anything else, so pastoral farming, could go through an RDA pathway, and that acknowledging also that in behind the scenes is the NES limiting dairy and dairy support expansion without a consent. So that's an added layer that would be on top of any dairy-related activity that was expanding. So it really just leaves sheep and beef under the RDA without any other mechanisms providing some oversight over that. And we did discuss that briefly during the conferencing. And I think one of the concerns with that was, again, as Mr. DeBousemaker said, we haven't got a sense of the kind of uptake that there might be of this, just how many pastoral farming systems might want to go down that pathway. And then, I guess, as well, comes back to that same issue that even if it is just sheep and beef operators, there really isn't a broader framework to assess effects that might result from the expansion. And so that's why I thought it might be okay for orchards and viticulture because of the evidence that there are typically lesser effects to be managed.
So in light of the evidence that has been given about the risks associated with irrigated pastoral systems, it wouldn't be appropriate to provide an RDA pathway in light of the lack of understanding about potential use of that pathway?
Possibly. I'm still actually a little bit on the fence about whether actually it's going to be such a confined issue, because we've actually only heard from one party. So I would have thought we would have heard from other parties, but they may not have turned their mind to it. So I'm still a little bit on the fence, but probably still err on the side of where we landed in the conferencing.
Ms. Perkins?
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with what Ms. Dicey has said at all, really. I think where we landed was erring on that side of caution, going, well, you know, acknowledging the concerns that have been raised, one, through evidence, and two, through some of the questions from the court, with regards to the potential, you know, cumulative and scale of effects. And I think we just don't have enough before us to determine how widespread that pastoral side of things could be. So it could be a bigger uptake than we might have thought. Bearing in mind it is still a six-year term, so people are limited to that term, so the risk is still on them for that uptake of area over a short term, not knowing the outcome or, you know, of the longer-term planning framework. But I would probably still to the direction we've landed in terms of limiting it to the orchard and viticulture.
Thank you. Mr. DePelsmaker.
Just one thing that I thought about. I'm a little bit cautious to rely on the NES regulations as kind of a safety net. They apply a threshold of 10 hectares, but also I don't actually think that they apply to dairy support, because it's only, I think, dairy farmland, which excludes dairy support. So, yeah, just wanted to add that.
Okay. The second point I wanted to understand a little further is the question of whether the stranded assets pathway is only available through the RDA in circumstances where the consent holder would be limited to their historical rates and volumes of take. Now, I understood that was the case from the presentation this morning, and so have I understood that is the intention?
Yes, Claire Perkins here. I'll just note that from my the way we drafted it, was the intention that there's no increase in rate or take, but the drafting we provided allows for where people haven't got a perfect metering record, so they can still add to that additional information requirement if their metering record's not ideal, but it is still limited to the historic rate of take use.
So, yeah, it is not limited to what is calculated under the schedule, but still the amount of water that is granted in a new consent should be in accordance with historical use. It is the RDA just gives you more opportunities, allows you to calculate or determine historic use through different avenues.
Now, I'm sure my friend Mr. Reid may ask you some questions about this, but thinking about the MacArthur Ridge situation where irrigation main lines had been installed for quite some time, but the last few blocks of grapes hadn't been added, I'm left wondering whether the solution here actually accommodates that factual situation, because the water necessary to irrigate those last few blocks wouldn't perhaps historically have been taken.
Well, Clipper, because I just note, my understanding of the MacArthur Ridge situation was that there wouldn't be an increase in historic rate and volume from my discussions with Mr. Davern on that initially. Mr. Reid might be able to confirm that, but that was my understanding.
I'll leave that to Mr. Reid to pursue. But if that's the case, that factual situation, which we do understand, would be covered then by the drafting that has been put forward.
Yes, that would be correct.
And then the final question I had relates to the new matter of discretion, subparagraph... Well, I'm looking at the joint witness statement, paragraph 20, subparagraph C, and then there's reference to a new matter of discretion suggested as follows, and this is the matter of discretion which enables consideration of good management practices. Now, I'll ask Ms. King perhaps to see whether she can assist in terms of how you might consider an application and what are the types of good management practices you'd expect to see for viticulture and orchards in this context.
Alexandra King, this was a discussion point during the conferencing, and Ms. Perkins and Ms. Dicey were able to direct me that both orchard and viticulture have well-known documents that outline good management practices for those purposes. So you'd be referring to those when assessing the application under that matter. And I'd just like to note that that's only for the additional areas rather than any current areas.
Perhaps Ms. Dicey or Ms. Perkins could assist in terms of sharing their understanding of the state of knowledge in terms of good management practices and the documents that perhaps have been discussed. Yeah, Ms. Perkins.
Chair Perkins, so my understanding, which was assisted by the input from Mr. Hodson at the time, there is a number of good management practices that are out in the public from the industry bodies. So, for example, Horticulture New Zealand has, they produce documents with regards to what are good agricultural practices. And I know, I understand that's to be the case across the range of bodies, so Dairy NZ and the likes, but obviously we're just looking at horticultural orchard and viticultural practices here. But there are industry standards available to represent that, and I know it's similar in other regions around the country as well with reference to good management practices.
Perhaps the reason for my question is there have been many days spent arguing about what good management practices actually might be, and the use of the phrase caught my attention, but it may well be, given the confined nature within which it is being used in this context, there is sufficient information out there to assist with informing a decision to be made.
Look, and I think I do take your point, and we did discuss this at some length amongst ourselves. But as you point out, we we came back to the fact that this was quite limited to probably a small number of parties, only on the additional irrigation areas, and that there is a reasonably good understanding of some standard sort of practices in relation to things like fertiliser use and the likes that would be in place here. And this is not the full land and water plan, the full breadth of good management practices across every type of land use.
Sorry, Garen, can you take that down until I say? That's to come.
I don't understand it to be defined in the operative regional...
No, I just ask, because it is in a lot of documents nowadays, it helps to define what it actually is. I just wanted to check that.
No, I don't understand it to be defined anywhere in the current planning framework.
I'm loath to suggest it be defined in this context without perhaps having seen the underlying documents. But in terms of, and perhaps it might assist, in terms of adding this matter of discretion, what was it you were seeking to achieve by adding it?
Claire Perkins, the main intention was to minimise any potential increase adverse effects on water quality. Counted with the evidence that we received or heard with regards to the effects from these particular land uses being lower risk, and it was just to effectively ensure that there is some form of mitigation or consideration of how water was used and how the land was used if you were to include a slightly increased area.
Okay. Now, the final question I had related to paragraph 25, but it relates to a comment that Ms. McIntyre made about drawing a distinction between sunk and unsunk investment. And I wasn't fully following where she might have been going. She has abandoned the good ship at PC7, so I'm not sure whether anyone else can assist with what distinction she was drawing in terms of paragraph 25.
I got the stick at the right end, but I believe that she basically, because one of the things that we try to achieve under Plan Change 7 is to protect people from making any investments that are going to be redundant or, through the new land and water plan. So her concern is that are we actually by providing a pathway for these situations, are we actually encouraging to make further investment to complete the irrigation? That is my interpretation. Yeah.
That makes sense. Thank you. Those were my questions.
Thank you. Any examination? Cross-examination? Mr. Reid?
Thank you, Your Honour. So, witnesses, I don't want to flog a dead horse on this issue about whether the stranded assets should be dealt with via a controlled activity exception or a restricted discretionary exception, but I just wanted to ask a few questions about the reasons for your electing to deal with it via a restricted discretionary pathway. So so I just wanted to perhaps just stand back for a moment and look at the way that you're proposing to deal, or the exception, whether it's dealt with as a controlled activity or a restricted discretionary activity. And my proposition is that the way that this is proposed to be dealt with is already very restrictive and very precautionary. And so I'll just ask you to comment on that. But the things that I would point to in that regard, and this is to answer Mr. Moore's point, the way that this has been put forward, at least by Strathclyde is that there would not, it would be within the existing historical water use that this was being, that this exception was being considered, so that the limitation on historical water use would continue to apply. There's obviously a limit on the date by which infrastructure has to be established. And there's now a limit on activity type, which I would suggest is very, very limited. And overall, the evidence that has been put forward by the submitters that have raised this concern, at least on the horticulture and viticulture side, covers a number of tens of hectares. That's the sort of scale of what we're talking about. So my overall proposition, which I'd ask you to comment on, is that this is a very limited and precautionary approach in relation to a very limited problem that is being considered. And in that context, does it need to be restricted discretionary?
Tom de Pelsmaker. I'll start off. First of all, the RDA pathway, as we see it as well, it's not an not a huge hurdle to jump. But what it does do is that it provides it gives more discretion to the consent authority. They can decline it. I acknowledge that in the case of MacArthur Ridge, we're dealing with a limited amount of hectares that are going to be added. But as I said before, we don't know really what the uptake is going to be across the region. So therefore, it's kind of hard to have any certainty around the cumulative impacts of that. Also, another consideration is like the controlled activity rule as it is now is quite, it's quite tight. By lumping in more activities, potentially you increase the information requirements or the matters of control, and they would apply to people that would just seek to roll over their consent without an expansion of the irrigated area.
Point you said there, the last point also.
Well, there are Tom de Pelsmaker again. Yeah. There are a number of matters of discretion in the proposed RDA that give consent authorities some leverage in terms of managing potential effects. If we would widen the controlled activity pathway as it is now, we would potentially end up bringing over those matters of discretion, which makes the rule a little bit more complex, gives council more discretion when considering applications just for a simple rollover, if I can use that term, of resource consents, and it creates uncertainty for the applicants. So it's just to keep the controlled activity rule a little bit more tight in that sense. That is not the major consideration, but it is also something I think that we should keep in mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Claire Perkins. Yes. Look, in my mind, it wasn't so much about the complexity of any rule, but rather that just the degree of risk, which is something that we were toying with. I sat very much on the fence, very close to the controlled activity pathway being the appropriate way forward in this situation. But it really just came down to the fact that if we know it was just probably those three that we've heard from, I don't think I'd have a problem with it there. It's just that slight increase in risk of a potential larger number of people, larger land areas falling into this, that kind of combined risk of all of them was sort of a bit unknown, hence the slightly more precautionary approach of putting in the RD pathway.
But would you agree with me that if there were larger scale applicants in this position who had undeveloped or stranded, in the stranded asset situation, that the court would have likely heard from them?
Ideally, yes, although I know from a number of clients in the even the pastoral farming side of things that the costs and process of being part of something like this is just something they're not willing to go down, recognising that their own risk and cost of a rural framework being put in place that they haven't been able to contribute to. But it's just too hard to know. There hasn't been a survey done of the wider Otago region knowing who may fall into this category or not.
All right. So my second question is just in relation to the matters over which you're proposing that the consent authority should have its discretion restricted, and they are in paragraph 20, as I understand it, the maximum size of the additional area irrigated and good management practice. Good, my friend Mr. Moore's already covered good management practice, but in relation to the first of those two matters, maximum size of the area to be irrigated, against what criteria would that matter be assessed?
Ms. King may be able to comment on this more, but really the matter of control is there just so a limit can be put on the area rather than determining whether or not that area was sufficient or not. It's more to enable a condition to the effect of limiting the maximum irrigation area.
So that it's not really a matter of discretion, is it, in that case? Is it, am I right in thinking?
Yeah, you're probably right there, but then it was do we need to have something there that allows for the consent officers to put a condition limiting the area on there?
Sorry, Alexandra King. I agree with Ms. Perkins in terms of my understanding as to why that was put in was to allow consents officers to impose a consent condition relating to the maximum area.
So it's just so clear, it's not contemplated that there should be some sort of maximum area that, to which this rule applies?
From my understanding, no.
Yes, thank you.
Re-examination? All right. You got any questions? No?
Yeah, well, I just had one. In terms of the council being able to decline it, what situation might you decline it in?
Perhaps if the additional irrigated area would be over a would pose a it would go against best management practices. Yeah.
So it would be that good management practices of could some accommodation couldn't be reached with the applicant in terms of management practices were, you might say no.
Yeah, I think you have to link it back to the matters of discretion. So that would be possibly your only consideration in that regard.
So if these applicants came along and signed up to various things in terms of these good management practices in their documents that were sort of capable of being converted to clear and enforceable conditions, that would probably be enough in terms of the council to actually grant this?
Yes, from my understanding, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
questions from me. Any questions, anything arising from the commissioner's question? No? All right. Well, very good. And thank you. Thank you, Ms. Perkins, for joining us again. It's been really helpful. So, as I indicated, I have a proposal for policy and wording in relation to the deemed permits. Do you want me to flick it up and distribute it?
Yes.
Chew on that. And look, I'm really serious. If I have tried to take out what are the essential elements which were proposed by the planners. So, and this is hopefully what's being reflected here. So it's your elements. And I've kind of approached this a bit like a criminal lawyer, where you're looking for the essential elements to be reflected in policy and the conditions. So that's how the drafting's been approached. I don't mind that it doesn't work. It's a bit, you know, if it doesn't work, then it's just an avenue closed. So I'm learning something, you know, that there has to be a different, yet a different tool, because I think the tool we had yesterday was problematic for a number of reasons. So it's okay, everyone, to say that it doesn't work. And we'll just look for another tool if we can. You'll see that when it comes up on the screen, there is three words or phrases shaded. They're only shaded because here I have some query within my mind as to whether I'm using terms correctly. So I think this is a new policy. With the applications to replace a deemed water permit that, as of the 18th of March 2020, was subject to a right of priority, the residual flow, because I think that's what you're talking about, it's the flow past the subservient consent holder, the residual flow at or below the point of take will be sufficient to supply an upstream permit holder. So upstream comes from Mr. Cummings' evidence. He thought maybe that would be useful. Entry conditions, so when that policy applies, the applicant proposes a condition to cease taking water when given notice. When it's probably notice in writing is given by an upstream permit holder, reservation of control or discretion, any condition to cease taking water when notice in writing is given by an upstream permit holder. You'll need to define some terms. Deemed permit, right and priority is going to be as per section 413. Upstream permit holder probably needs to be linked back to the deemed permits and the list of linked permits in terms of linked permits and notice. It's your notice of 72 hours. That's what notice means, notice in writing, 72 hours. So that's the broad proposition. So and it's subject to any various challenges as well. So I'll print that off, invite everybody to chew on that, as I said. The words at or below, I think you've got your own jargon for this plan. I just don't know what it is, whether it's at or whether it's below. But really, quite like that idea of the 18th March 2020, if there is a problem, and certainly Dr. Somerville saying there is a problem come 1 October, so I like that idea. It doesn't get around Dr. Somerville's problem in terms of the risk to farmers going forward or other deemed permit holders going forward, but it's helpful, I thought. So deemed permits, as of that date, had a right of priority. I don't know whether, I think residual flow is what you're talking about. I think it has to be at the point of take. And there's something to do with sufficiency to supply another person. And I've got sufficiency straight out of the Section 13 of the Water and Soil Amendment Act, and I couldn't think of a better word to use. Also, cognizant, Ms. Dicey, of your explanation yesterday, well, actually, farmers are pretty familiar with these terms, sufficiency. I don't know whether that's front and foremost of their mind, but they're familiar in principle with these terms. This would apply on receding flows through natural reasons, but what it is trying to do is ensure that the permit, which has the superior right,
is left water in the river, which I thought was what the rights of priority were doing. So it is, you know, to use your language, it's trying to mimic, or it's not entirely replicating, it's trying to echo those flow sharing arrangements, but bringing it into RMN, RMA language for an RMA purpose. So that's my offering this morning. And we'll print that off, see what you think about it. If it doesn't fly, that's fine. We'll look for another solution.
Just one question of clarification, if I might.
Okay.
I'm just looking at the proposed policy and the very last part of that, to supply any upstream permit holder.
Oh, maybe any's wrong.
Yeah, and I'm just contemplating... Or it's an upstream permit holder that had the right of priority, as opposed to each and every RMA permit held.
No, you're quite right. And then, you might pick that up in the definition,
yes.
You see upstream permit holder is a permit holder who had a right of priority.
Yes.
So, you know, I just didn't want to stick too many things in the policy, but then you're sort of relying on the good definition driving it, but you're right.
Yep.
And not any... it's not any upstream permit holder by any means. It's those who are holding the rights.
That follows. No, that's helpful. We'll chew that over and explore it.
Okay, so Rachel's going to print that off for you, and then we can... But, you know, you all do need to come back to us about what to do with those priorities, because I think what's being proposed is problematic. Yeah.
Agreed.
And so then where do we go?
May I ask a question of clarification, Mum? I wonder whether we've got our upstreams and our downstreams
around
the right way.
You are probably right. And I had actually thought about that myself this morning, thinking, yikes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think in the policy and in the reservation of control, it should be the other way around.
Should be written given by the downstream permit holder? Yes, probably. Yeah. Yes. I tell you what, I'll amend that so I won't embarrass myself in front of those planners. yeah, you're right. It is. But, you know.
We understand.
Yeah. No, I'm not trying to do something totally novel. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll change the... I'll make the amendments. Here we go, losing the Y. I'll make the amendments and then we'll distribute it. But are looking for... really do need to get some feedback in terms of, well, what's going to happen in light of the, you know, cross-examination with the panel yesterday. Is this offering something worthwhile being explored? Well, if it's not, that's fine. Where do you want to go? We've got to land it. Because if we don't land it, then it seems to me you can reject Plan Change 7, but that's a risk assessment in terms of who is exposed and the significance of the exposure. You can reject it. You can go with perhaps the Ms. Dicey approach, which is long-term consents, because we know that should secure a minimum flow, which should supplant the regime. So reject it, go with the discretionary consent, or put in a policy that might work. Seems to be the options to me. Or government. That'll be the third time I've said it. But, you know, government need not step in if we can make this work. And I think the other thing that worries me, possibly, and again, I'm just not close enough, and Ms. King, you'll be far closer than I. So Ms. Dicey has proposed a fully discretionary activity, which hopefully is going to give a minimum flow and residual flows and all the good stuff that'll be replacing permits. Well, I know that because Ms. Dicey has proposed it, therefore it should be true for Ms. Dicey's clients. I don't know that it's true for every applicant in Otago, and that's what I'm worried about. It's like if we go with that solution... we've still potentially got a bunch of folk out there who's going to be caught out. Yeah, and Ms. Dicey, you're agreeing there'll be a bunch of folk out there caught out. Okay, so it seems to me I've got no... unless government steps in, we have no option. We actually have to be providing a solution here. And so this is why I've offered it. How does that sound?
Yeah,
Okay, and you agree with Ms. Dicey. Look, beyond Ms. Dicey's clients, there are people who are not going to avail themselves of Ms. Dicey's solution, not least because they don't have Galaxids living in their waterway, but because it just simply hasn't been proposed the way that Ms. Dicey, their applications haven't been formulated the way Ms. Dicey conceives them, which is, you know, whole catchment, subcatchment with a few imperiled Galaxids in locality, and that's not every application. So we've got, there are risks about which we, yeah, you agree with Ms. Dicey on that? Yeah, okay. All right, here we go. All right, I'll do the edits before we show the planners. Yep, and we'll see where we go. All right, and you'll talk to your friends about...
Yes, about what we might do from a process perspective.
Yeah.
Yes, okay. We'll start that discussion over the lunch break.
Very good. All right, thank you. And I'll get that to you shortly in the next 5 minutes. I'll just take it away and do it in the chambers. So we're adjourned through till 2:15. Yeah, actually, I won't do it in chambers. I'll do it here because it's more convenient than bouncing up and down. All right, so we're adjourned, and just ignore me. Doing homework.
All rise.
Off you go. I'll just finish the typing. Yep.